This is the end. Beautiful friend.
This is John Amundson. I want to welcome you to the next podcast in a series of podcasts presented for you by the Psychologist Association of Alberta. The purpose of the podcast is to present information that's timely, topical, and even controversial to the membership. Sorry for the long lead-in. It was The Doors, and I wanted to come up with a song that had something to do with the end, because we're going to talk today about medical assistance in dying and a feminist perspective as seen through a feminist lens or narrative. Then we're also going to talk a little bit about spanking. I did a podcast a little while back where APA had sort of taken a position on the negative influences and effects of spanking. And there's been a comment in the American Psychologist on this, two comments, which I think are really interesting. So in just a second, we'll get on with the podcast for today. You gotta love The Doors, don't you? Okay, so the article that I'm looking at is written by the author is a woman named Canetto, and it is in Professional Psychology Research and Review. The title of it is "If Physician-Assisted Suicide is the Modern Woman's Last Powerful Choice, Why Are White Women Its Leading Advocates and Main Users?" And the premise in this is that white women have been overrepresented in the process of establishing, they use the term physician-assisted suicide, we'll use medical assistance in dying, have been at the forefront in establishing its availability as represented in memberships and societies and institutions, and are also at the forefront in its use. So more white women are using medical assistance in dying than would be other ethnic groups. And Canetto says, as we understand, that anything we look at, anything we think of, can be seen through a gendered lens and radicalized contexts, meaning that there are forces and dynamics that will underride a lot of the actions and decisions in society. So let's take a look at what she says about this. She says there are several contexts that need to be considered. The first one is that women are less likely through the course of their life to have accumulated wealth, and women are more likely to outlive their husbands. And they are more exposed to ideologies and practices that devalue them. So when white women become older and ill, they have internalized a lot of these sentiments, and they see themselves as less valued and hence as a burden. So this idea of being a burden in medical assistance in dying, only about 5% of the individuals who apply have a psychological, psychiatric evaluation. Usually the physicians have determined their competencies. But in those 5%, one of the reasons to exclude someone is if they were entirely driven or a decision was determined by their sense of being a burden. But there is this feminist critique of medical assistance in dying because women are more likely to perceive themselves as a burden. A second one that is implied in her work is that, and again, this is a gendered wrinkle, is that women are socialized to be more, quote, compassionate, caring, empathetic, and more affectively grounded. Hence their support for medical assistance because of that compassionate sense of dignity, a death with dignity, death with compassion, death with kindness. And then white women are, and this is her phrase, they're aspiring to hegemonic femininity ideals, the practice of judging oneself, internalizing that based upon these hegemonic femininity ideals around I'm a person of care and compassion and engagement in an empathetic way with others. White women are who she's looking at as opposed to women of color. She says that there is this sense of a fulfillment of one's role in destiny. And so probably women and men are both held by this gendered sense of what counts to be a real person. And she says that many white women will say, medical assistants, and Diane was going to use her term, applies to me because I have fulfilled my roles and my obligations as a woman. Overarching in this is also the desire, the need, and the aspirations for control over one's destiny. Many years ago, I think it was in the 1940s, Otto Rank, one of the early Freudians, had a really unique twist on this idea of gendered ideology. And he said, there is masculine ideology and feminine psychology. And in that, a woman can either accept the role that has been defined for her under masculine ideology or rebel against that role. But in neither way does she become herself. So medical assistance in dying is one way for perhaps women to seize control of their own destiny outside of the determinants of other ideological forces. So there we go. Medical assistance in dying from a feminine through a feminine lens and feminine narrative. In the article on spanking, it was by Gersoff, and the first critique is that that most of the material that they used was correlational, and selection bias and all of the things that would be part of the studies that are involved in correlational work that underwrites public policy. So they feel that the control group for this should have been experimental. Control group where people have used timeout or other forms of punishment to see if there's an equivalent impact on children, and so they just kind of take it on a methodological level, and they think everybody's working in good faith. But can they actually say what they said? Gersoff had said massive amounts of studies have shown that physical punishment, corporal punishment of children, is a bummer and it shouldn't be undertaken. But the other one that was really good was a comment where it's from the University of Connecticut and Central Connecticut State University. And what they said is that it is the perception of rejection, acceptance and rejection, that mediates the impact of any kind of punishment, and especially corporeal punishment. That there is research that has shown cross-culturally that use of physical punishment in certain cultures is far less aversive. And they believe what mediates this is that even where there's physical punishment, when they understand, the child understands that there is acceptance underwriting this. Ta-Nehisi Coates, in his book Between the World and Me, he talks about his father. His father was a black nationalist, and he says his father used to give him beatings. But he said his father gave him beatings because he was terrified that his son would find the conventional path to achievement, which was part of his upbringing in subsidized housing. I'm making this up at this point, in New Jersey, I think. That he, you know, when he wouldn't go to school, when he was hanging out, and he said he got physical punishment, but you can here inherent in what Ta-Nehisi Coates is saying is that my father had such profound fear for the well-being of his son. So there was a sense of acceptance in that. So they argue about that, and I think that's kind of a cool thing that that we need to think of. When punishment is used, does punishment ride on the back of rejection? In other words, the categorical sort of breaking of the attachment that leads to anxious feelings of isolation, or in that feeling, the agitated behavior of a child to try to connect. So is there an acceptance shell that surrounds a punishment, or a rejection shell? So I think that's kind of cool. In a final article that I want to review today, it's on the concept of creativity anxiety, and it was in the Journal of Experimental Psychology General, 2019. And what the authors speak about is how creativity anxiety is necessary in everything from STEM to the arts. In other words, from the right to the left, the creativity anxiety is profoundly important. Now, they've coined this term, and they talk about creativity anxiety as opposed to non-creativity anxiety, the rumination obsession we see often in clinical practice and in patients. The reason I like this one is I've talked about functional neuroses and not creative anxiety, but you know, facilitative and useful anxiety, that individuals who have a functional anxiety or creative neurosis, I guess we can interchange that either way, are going to be on top of their game. And this, of course, ties in with a lot of research that's been done on conscientiousness, big C, as the factor that is underscoring and underwriting performance in human well-being, that individuals who have greater conscientiousness of the big five, O-C-E-A-N, ocean. I won't name all of them. I'd only do that to amuse myself and feel like, hey, I got a great memory. But the C, the conscientiousness, seems to be the factor that is associated with well-being and even longevity. So these folks are looking at this, but looking at it as they have an instrument for measuring, and they say there's a novel construct, a unique and novel construct, creativity, anxiety, that would be probably a subset of conscientiousness in the big five. So we'll have the Doors, March is not the only other song they have that has something to do with death in it.